content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the March 28, 2026 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, My Childhood in the Weather Underground. My parents founded the radical revolutionary group, then became fugitives. I was born in hiding and spent my early years on the run, by Zaid Ayers-Dorn. One cold morning in 1980, when I was not yet 4 years old, my mother woke me while it was still dark, pressing her face against my cheek. "We have to leave," she whispered, "right away." I rolled off my mattress, pulled on some clothes, and followed her down 5 flights of stairs without a word, carrying my sneakers and walking on tiptoe so I didn't wake the neighbors. Outside, my father was already chipping ice from the windshield of our rusted station wagon. My mom stood in the doorway. Her hair, which she had kept short and dyed red as part of a disguise, was starting to grow out, straight and dark down to her shoulders. She stood still, cradling my baby brother, but her eyes kept flickering to the Harlem intersection, following each car that passed. Finally, my dad whistled twice, our usual signal, one short, one long, and she led me into the back seat. My dad glanced behind us once to see if we were being followed, winked at me in the rearview mirror, and then swung our car toward Interstate 80, headed west. My memories of this time are hazy, of course. I remember them the way anyone remembers the important moments of their childhood, overlaid with family lore, stories my parents told, and details I've reconstructed from recent conversations. But underneath it all, there are real sense memories. Among my earliest, maybe imprinted by the fear of that night, the cold smell of the city, and the fuzzy disorientation of waking up while it was still dark out. I remember wondering why we were leaving and what was going to happen to us next. A decade earlier, my mother, Bernadine Dorn, had declared war on the United States government. She and my father, Bill Ayers, helped found the militant revolutionary group, the Weather Underground, and committed themselves to opposing the Vietnam War and fighting back violently against what they saw as a fascist police state here at home. They and their friends set off bombs at the New York Police Department headquarters, the Capitol, the State Department, and the Pentagon. They wore disguises, lived under fake names, built a network of safe houses, and became the focus of an international manhunt. In 1970, the FBI director J. Edgar Hoover called my mom the most dangerous woman in America. That October, she became only the 4th woman in history on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. I was born underground and spent my early years on the run. By 1980, though, my parents had finally decided to turn themselves in. A plea deal awaited us in Chicago, but for the deal to work, we had to make it to the courthouse in person. If we were caught along the way, my mom would spend decades in prison. It was a tense drive that night. My dad says that he kept our station wagon well below the speed limit. The next morning, we pulled into a rest stop Burger King. While my mom stayed in the car to nurse the baby, my father and I went inside, and a nice elderly couple started talking to me in line, just making conversation. "Hey, sweetheart," the man said, smiling down at me. I had shoulder-length blonde hair at the time, and people always assumed I was a girl. "You all on vacation?" I knew I wasn't supposed to talk to strangers, but my dad was busy ordering our food, and I felt like I had to say something. My response has, in the years since, become a running joke in my family. "We're going to Chicago," I told him, "so my mom can turn herself into the FBI. My dad turned, surprised, trying to catch up. "Oh, yeah, I don't know," he said, trying to force a laugh. "Maybe something he saw on TV." Hey, Z, you need to use the bathroom before we go? Say bye. I waved, and before we got our food, he picked me up and ran for our car. As he peeled back out onto the highway, he told my mom that he thought somebody had recognized him. He was trying to protect me, I think. My dad knew that I was desperate not to disappoint my mother, that I wouldn't want to admit I had broken the underground's strict codes of secrecy. I looked up to her. I admired her. I wanted to be like her. Of course, as I got older, that got more complicated. My parents' brand of violent resistance, I now know, had tragic consequences for our family and deadly costs for the people around us. Three of my parents' closest friends were killed in an accidental dynamite explosion as they planned an attack on a U.S. Army base. Others spent decades behind bars, leaving their children without mothers or fathers. And years later, when the group splintered into increasingly militant factions, some took part in a disastrous bank robbery that killed an innocent guard and two police officers, three men who were just doing their jobs that day, and who left behind their own kids, their own families. Of course, I didn't know any of this at the time. I just remember watching my mom's face in the rearview mirror, wondering what she was thinking, whether she was also scared, as she scanned the maps in our faded Rand McNally Road Atlas. In our family, my father was usually the one driving, but there was never any doubt who was setting our direction. "Get off at the next exit," she ordered him. "We'll switch to local roads." My mother wasn't always a revolutionary. She grew up a middle-class white girl in Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. Her dad was the credit manager for a local chain of appliance stores, a second-generation Jewish immigrant, and a lifelong Republican. My mom seemed, at first, eager to please. She was a straight-A student and, at 17, became the first person in the family to go to college at the University of Chicago, where she soon went on to law school as one of only a handful of co-eds in her first-year class. By letting your daughter see more of the world than you did means that she might come to see that world quite differently. In 1966, Martin Luther King Jr. came to Chicago to lead a series of protests against racism and housing discrimination. "Seeing King night after night speaking in churches," my mom told me recently, "it changed my life." The civil rights movement needed lawyers, ideally people willing to work for free, and she soon signed up to volunteer. "I knew nothing," she said, laughing. "Second-year law student, I had an armband that said legal. It was ridiculous." In 1968, my mother was in New York when she heard screams coming from the street outside. Dr. King had just been killed in Memphis, Tennessee. My mom grabbed her purse and got on the subway to 42nd Street. "I don't know why I did," she told me, "but by the time I got there, there were thousands and thousands of people in Times Square. I wanted to be in a crowd of people who were mourning and angry, both." That rage drove her away from King's politics of nonviolence and toward a more militant ideology. She was soon elected to the national leadership of Students for a Democratic Society, the largest student protest group in the country at that time. It was through SDS that she met my dad, the son of a prominent utilities CEO. He had grown up in a wealthy suburb of Chicago, burned his draft card at the University of Michigan, and then dropped out of school to protest full time. Then, in 1969, my mother split SDS in half, forming a more radical faction of the group called Weathermen. The name was taken from the lyrics of Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues. "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows." That October, Weathermen rampaged through Chicago's upscale shopping district, the Magnificent Mile, with bricks, chains, and baseball bats, breaking windows, smashing cars, and brawling with armed police officers, the so-called Days of Rage riots. Their statement following the protest gave the title to Paul Thomas Anderson's recent film about modern American revolutionaries. From here on, it's one battle after another, with white youth joining in the fight and taking the necessary risks. Pig America, beware. There's an army growing in your guts, and it's going to bring you down. My mother had found a new, more revolutionary role model to follow, Fred Hampton, the charismatic 21-year-old chairman of the Chicago Black Panthers. They became friends and comrades. The Weathermen and Panthers held meetings together and exchanged intel about government surveillance and police informants. It seemed for a moment that they might help realize Hampton's dream of an interracial rainbow coalition of radical activist groups. But 2 months later, Hampton was also dead, executed by Chicago police while he slept in his bed with his pregnant girlfriend beside him. An FBI informant had spiked Fred's Kool-Aid with a sedative so he wouldn't wake up during the deadly late-night raid. This new killing drove my mother and her friends over the edge. "I was in a rage," she told me, still visibly furious decades later, "at the absolute stench of American life." The next night, weathermen placed plastic coffee cups filled with black powder under the hoods of police squad cars across Chicago. The explosion wrecked the cruisers and blew out the windows of nearby buildings. A few months later, my mom and dad, along with roughly 100 other members of the group, changed their names, cut ties with their families, and disappeared. On May 21, 1970, an audio tape was delivered to newspapers across the country on behalf of their newly renamed group, the Weather Underground. "Hello, this is Bernadine Dorn," the recording begins. "I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war." 2 weeks later, a dynamite bomb exploded on the second floor of the New York Police Department headquarters. President Richard Nixon immediately called an emergency Oval Office meeting. "Hundreds, perhaps thousands of Americans, mostly under 30, are determined to destroy our society," he told his intelligence chiefs. "I do not intend to sit idly by while self-appointed revolutionaries commit acts of terrorism throughout the land." When I was still a kid, driving with my parents across the country, I think I imagined that the underground was a physical place, as if it might have its own two-page spread in the road atlas, mapping a hidden archipelago of safe houses, communes, and meet-up spots, a whole secret subterranean geography. But it wasn't a place, really. My father used to say that it was just a state of mind. "I went underground by changing my name," he told me. "One day I was one thing, and the next day I was another." Finding a new name was surprisingly easy. A weatherman would drive out to a rural graveyard and look around until he found the headstone of a person who would have been about his age, but had died as an infant. Then he'd head over to the county courthouse and ask for a replacement birth certificate. Soon, he would have an official government license with his photo, but a new name and a whole new identity. My dad grew his beard out. My mom cut her hair short, dyed it red, and started dressing like a California hippie, big glasses and flowing dresses, rather than in her signature black leather miniskirts and knee-high boots. They set up safe houses, cheap apartments in working-class neighborhoods. They took jobs as construction workers, longshoremen, and nannies, work that didn't require a Social Security card and always paid at the end of the day in cash. Meanwhile, their bombing campaign intensified. In July, a bomb shook a U.S. Army base near the Golden Gate Bridge. The next day, an explosion shattered the glass and marble lobby of the Bank of America building in New York. The method they used was simple. A young white woman dressed up as a secretary would walk into a building, place a bag or a purse in an empty restroom or office, set a timer, and walk out. A few hours later, someone would call in a warning. Minutes after that, the bomb would explode. The warning calls mostly prevented serious casualties. After an accidental explosion in a West Village bomb factory killed three weathermen, those who survived, shaken by their friends' deaths, swore off deadly violence. But the attacks, though meant to be symbolic, were still dangerous and reckless. And although weathermen today still insist that they were not terrorists, that their bombs were intended not to maim or kill, but to send a message, the fact is that setting off bombs carries an implicit threat of violence. It can terrorize people. And while there may be moments in history when some of us would concede the necessity of illegal, violent resistance, Nazi Germany, say, or the South under chattel slavery, dynamite is a self-defeating tool in a democracy, however imperfect. Blowing up buildings doesn't help build a mass movement or create momentum for lasting change. But if the goal was to draw attention, the Weather Underground's bombing campaign was a huge success. It turned my mother into a symbol, a heroic anti-government outlaw to some, a violent un-American terrorist to many more. Actors and rock stars from the counterculture scene, including the band Jefferson Airplane, started donating money and cars to the cause. Alt weeklies reprinted my mother's mugshot with the message, "Bernadine Dorn, welcome here." Teenagers hung the page in their windows or on their walls, like today's dorm room posters of Che Guevara, or Malcolm X, or Tupac. Less a sign of a specific political ideology than an impressionistic display of youthful rebellion. That September, my parents were contacted by a cult of weed and LSD dealers in California with the incredible name, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, who wanted help breaking their hero, Timothy Leary, out of prison. Leary, a Harvard psychologist turned acid guru, had become famous for urging people to use LSD, to turn on, tune in, drop out. He had been sentenced to 20 years behind bars for possession of two marijuana joints, an early test case in the government's war on drugs, and the members of the Brotherhood were determined to free him. In exchange for a paper bag full of cash, $20,000 in unmarked bills, the Weather Underground agreed to do the job. They came up with a plan. Using blueprints smuggled in by a radical lawyer representing both Leary and my mother, they gave Leary instructions on how to climb, hand over hand, along a telephone wire for more than 200 feet across the prison campus in the middle of the night. Once over the concrete wall, he dropped down to a patch of grass where a group of weathermen were waiting in a van, dressed to look like a family on a fishing trip. They quickly dyed Leary's hair, gave him new clothes and a passport, and spirited him out of the country. But not before he and my parents celebrated together in a forest clearing, smoking a joint and listening to Jimi Hendrix. It was fun, my mom remembers. I mean, we're standing there in a redwood grove in California, and there's all these headlines about him being gone. As the decade wore on, though, my parents grew up, as happens to young rebels. And my mother unexpectedly started thinking about having kids. "Maybe it was turning 30," she told me. I was so adamant until that moment. I was really sure that wasn't going to be me. And suddenly, it was me. I don't know how to explain it. She found out she was pregnant from a free clinic in the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood of San Francisco. Home pregnancy tests were not yet widely available, so she had to risk showing up at the clinic in person and then calling for the results a few days later. The nurse on the line sounded apologetic as she broke the news. Most unmarried women were apparently eager for a negative result. "I'm so sorry to tell you this," she said, "but you're pregnant." My mother, though, was ecstatic. "Ah," she shouted into the phone, "that's so wonderful." My parents rented a scruffy one-bedroom apartment overlooking a park in the Fillmore District. They bought bags of thrifted baby clothes and decorated the apartment with cheap wall hangings and stuffed toys. "We'd been safe for a long time," she told me when I asked whether she considered the dangers of having a child while she was a fugitive. "I felt that we knew how to be safe. They found a midwife through trusted friends, and I was born at home in the spring of 1977 in a safe house underground. My parents never lied to me about any of this, except maybe by omission. My mom says she tried to explain it to me so a four-year-old could understand. We were part of a rebel alliance, like Luke Skywalker or Princess Leia fighting an evil empire. We were outlaws, like the animated fox from Disney's Robin Hood, stealing from the rich to give to the poor. So I knew from my earliest memories that my parents had broken the law and that the FBI was chasing us. But I don't think I ever understood exactly who or what FBI was. Why did FBI want to catch us? What would happen if it did? I had no way to imagine a federal agency. To me, it just felt like a scary presence pursuing our family all the time, a childhood bogeyman. According to my parents, by the time I was three, I had learned to recognize plainclothes cops and FBI agents in a crowd. You had to look at their shoes, cheap leather loafers, well-shined, and their cars, American-made, stripped down, but with souped-up radio antennas and the telltale rumble of an upgraded V8. They taught me never to use landlines that could be traced. We carried rolls of dimes in our pockets and made our calls from payphones. I learned to speak in code. Brown shoes meant undercover agents. Living on the run was being in on the joke. When I was four, I learned to walk a trajectory, the complicated mix of turns and switchbacks we used to lose a tail. Up the stairs, onto the elevated tracks, wait 2 minutes, double back again, through the park, across the basketball courts, around the corner. It was a bit like playing a game, a grown-up version of dress-up or hide-and-seek, but only my family knew all the rules. At every place we stopped for more than a week or two, my parents got new jobs, dyed their hair strange colors, spoke in new accents, and took on unfamiliar names. My mom went by Louise Lou Douglas, Rose Brown, Lorraine Ann Jellins, H.T. Smith, Sharon Louise Naylor, and Karen Lois DeBellius. My dad became Joe Brown, Tony Lee, Jules Michael Taylor, Hank Anderson, and Michael Joseph Rafferty. I wanted to be part of their grown-up world. So, even though no one knew my real name anyway, and I wouldn't have a birth certificate until I was five, around strangers, they started calling me Z. It all seemed strangely normal. Pretty much everyone I knew back then was a fugitive. And over the years, I met other kids whose parents were also on the run. Panther Cubs and weather kids, like me, with no school and no regular place to call home. Jad Joseph, whose father, Jamal, was an underground member of the New York Black Panthers, remembers his dad telling their family to get ready for a car trip and snapping, "If you're 30 seconds late, someone could die." Jad told me, "I was just like, Dad, no one's going to die because we're late to Grandma's." Other friends remember being toted around as beards when their parents were out scouting bombing runs. The idea was that a couple with a kid in tow wouldn't look too suspicious taking a walk near a police station or an army base. My friend Ty, whose parents were part of the Weather Underground leadership, remembers his father, Jeff Jones, coming home one day to find their family's Hoboken apartment surrounded by cops. A fire inspector had spotted his tiny crop of marijuana plants on the fire escape. Jeff picked Ty up at preschool that afternoon, and their family never went home. They abandoned everything they owned overnight: medical records, books, baby pictures, toys. My family spent time at communes in Oregon, where I played with other kids in a waterfall we called the washing machine, and learned to milk the cow, named, naturally, Emma Goldmilk. We stayed in trailer parks in Virginia and flop houses in the slums of Detroit. But I noticed, leafing through the road atlas, that we never visited the tourist sites the guide suggested: Disneyland, the Hoover Dam, the Alamo. On the rare occasions we took time to sightsee in my family, It was to visit monuments to injustice, the bloody sites of lynchings and massacres and violent uprisings, so I could internalize lessons in radical resistance. "These were freedom fighters," my mom would whisper. "This is where they were murdered. Remember, you're a freedom fighter too." I didn't much feel like a freedom fighter, and given the gruesome, tragic ends that seemed to meet most of my parents' heroes, I wasn't at all sure I wanted to become one. Still, despite all the obvious danger, I knew that my parents would always protect me, no matter what. This was the foundation on which my shaky sense of security was built, that my birth had changed everything. My mother and father always told me that they had stopped taking part in violent actions after I was born, that they had committed themselves, for the sake of our family, to a different kind of future. But, like most origin stories, I now know that ours was mostly a myth. By the late 70s, my family was back in Harlem. My father, as Tony Lee, had taken a job as a teacher at my preschool so he could keep an eye on me. My mother was pregnant again, working at an upscale kids' clothing boutique on 81st Street called Broadway Baby. As I learned only recently, the job offered an unexpected side benefit. Whenever my mom met a customer of a certain type, a woman who was young, white, and pregnant like her, she would ask for an ID to verify a check, and then quickly memorize her personal information. A few days later, a woman would walk into a DMV office and tell the clerk she'd lost her ID. She would verify her identity with the correct name, birthday, address, and license number, and be issued a replacement on the spot. These IDs were then used to rent vehicles that were used in a spree of bank robberies by former members of the Black Panthers and the Weather Underground, fugitive splinter cells determined to keep the revolution alive. Sometime around 1978 or 1979, my parents took me on my first camping trip to Alderson, West Virginia. My memories of the trip are vague and impressionistic, mostly based on stories I heard later. But I think of it as a fun few weeks, my first time pitching a tent, cooking on a portable gas-powered stove, lying on a blanket under the stars. Recently, though, as I reconstructed my family's path through the underground, I noticed something strange about that particular dot in the road atlas. Our campsite was right next door to a federal prison, FPC Alderson, which in 1979 was best known for holding a female inmate named Asata Shakur. Shakur had been a leading member of the New York Black Panthers, a group that joined my parents underground in the early 70s, re-Christianed themselves as the Black Liberation Army, and launched an all-out war against the New York Police Department, sparking a series of bloody confrontations in which both police officers and members of the Black Underground were killed. Shakur was, like my mom, young, militant, female, and photogenic, and she soon became a political symbol and the focus of a joint FBI-NYPD manhunt. The NYPD's former deputy commissioner called Shakur the soul of the BLA, the mother hen who kept them together, kept them moving, kept them shooting. Shakur was finally arrested in 1973 after a traffic stop turned into a deadly firefight that killed two state troopers, wounded Shakur, and killed her best friend, the man I'm named after, Zaid Malik Shakur. By 1978, when we took our family camping trip to West Virginia, Asata had been locked up for 4 years, and her friends in the Black Underground were desperate to free her. When I pointed out to my father the coincidence of our camping location, he finally admitted, though their involvement isn't publicly known, that they had been recruited to case the prison. We took a lot of pictures, he told me, drawing maps and trying to figure out if there was a way to get Asata out. There was a sense that a couple of young white people with a baby could do anything without attracting any attention. The maps were never used, because Shakur was transferred from West Virginia to a prison in New Jersey. That fall, an old friend reached out to my father through the underground communications network, dialing a number printed on a faded piece of plastic Dymo tape and speaking to him from a public phone booth. A few days later, my dad watched from a high rock outcropping as the man walked a trajectory through Central Park. Finally, they fell in step on the bridle path around the reservoir, and the man got down to business. The Black Liberation Army had a job for Bill to do, something illegal and potentially dangerous. I remember weighing it with Bernadine very heavily, my dad told me, when I asked him about the choice he made that day. I didn't really want to do it on some level, but on another level, I wanted nothing more than to do it. You were a father, I reminded him. Didn't you think about that, about the risks you were taking? Well, it's like everything else about being involved in the movement, he said. On the one hand, like every other human being, the speck of the universe you understand best is your life. So you want to have that. On the other hand, if you're a person who's made a commitment to something larger, you want that larger thing to work also. And so it's never quite left me, this contradiction. How do you take responsibility for yourself and your family, and at the same time take some responsibility for the larger world? A few weeks later, my dad called in sick to work at my preschool. He left me at home with my mom, who was now 7 months pregnant with my brother, and caught a train to a parking garage downtown. There he found a van waiting for him. The key was under the mat. A garage ticket was tucked into the visor. An hour later, he parked the van outside a Lane Co. department store in a strip mall in New Jersey and settled down to wait. A few miles away, the BLA paramilitary leader, Sekou Odinga, arrived at the prison. He handed over an ID, signed the visitor's log with a fake name, and was taken in to see Shakur. They embraced, and under the cover of the hug, Odinga passed her a .357 Magnum revolver. The pair quickly took a prison matron hostage. Within minutes, two more armed BLA soldiers arrived, handcuffed the guard at gunpoint, and, with Shakur, piled into a hijacked van, drove out through the gates of the prison without firing a shot, and scattered into waiting getaway cars driven by white friends from the underground. A few miles away, my dad's BLA contact knocked on his window, loaded something or someone into the back of his van, and told him to drive. My father still isn't sure what he was carrying. He doesn't think it was Shakur herself. But the underground had to disperse a wide range of people and equipment that day, guns and fugitives and members of the support network. One of the things about an action like that, he told me, is the elaborateness of it means that you can play a very small role in a small corner, not even fully understanding what the larger piece is. But as he pulled the van onto a road in New Jersey, heading toward Manhattan, he started to feel nervous. I had my hands on the wheel at 10 and 2, he remembered. I was trying to look as normal as I possibly could. Then he saw a roadblock ahead, a state trooper waving half the cars over for a search. They were on to it, he told me. It was really terrifying. But, of course, the whole point of me driving the van is I'm a young white guy driving a van, and they're not looking for that. He held his breath, hoping the white edge would hold. He looked right at me, and I just went by. I remember very clearly being absolutely giddy once I passed that cop. I made it. I got through. I had survived. He parked the van, left the key and the parking ticket, called in its location, and came back home. In 1984, Shakur surfaced in Havana, where she was granted political asylum by Fidel Castro's leftist government. She lived in Cuba for decades, giving talks and writing her autobiography, and became a global symbol of Black liberation, what she called a maroon, or escaped slave. Shakur died last year, having inspired generations of Black writers and activists, hip-hop artists like Nas and Mos Def, and the character of the militant Perfidia Beverly Hills played by Tayana Taylor in the film One Battle After Another. But for me, the story of Shakur's jailbreak was not just a piece of radical political history, but a surprising revelation about my own family. Because though I had always understood, growing up, that my parents were willing to sacrifice their friends, their freedom, and even their lives for their cause, it had somehow never occurred to me that they were willing to sacrifice my brother and me, too. "Did you really think about what would happen if you were caught?" I asked my father recently. He's 81 now, with glasses and wisps of white hair sticking out from under his baseball cap. "Yeah," he said, "I thought my life would end." "So why?" "Because it mattered," he said. "Because the world needed it to happen." Shakur's escape turned out to be the final successful action of the revolutionary undergrounds of the 1970s. 2 months later, in early 1980, my brother Malik was born, and my parents decided to turn themselves in. Our flop house in Harlem was growing crowded. Not with possessions. Malik's crib, like mine, was a dresser drawer lined with blankets. But just as some parents realize after their second kid that they're going to need a larger place or a minivan, my mother decided that a family of four was just too big for the underground lifestyle. "I felt like we hadn't hurt you too much by having you be a fugitive," she told me. Well, I didn't agree exactly, but I let it slide. Two kids was another thing. And you were getting older. The world had moved on. So that December, my parents woke me up in the middle of the night for our last cross-country drive through the underground. In a courthouse in Chicago, surrounded by police and microphones, my mother read a brief statement, making it clear that surrendering didn't mean she was giving up. "I regret not at all our efforts to side with the forces of liberation," she told the judge. "I remain committed to the struggle ahead." She pleaded guilty to bail jumping and to aggravated battery, misdemeanors left over from the days of rage riots 10 years earlier, when a cop had tried to grab her and she kicked him in the testicles. She paid a $1,500 fine and was released that same day with 3 years of probation. It still amazes me that a former most wanted fugitive could escape with a slap on the wrist. But my mom had been underground for a long time. Most of the charges against her had been dropped due to FBI misconduct exposed in the COINTELPRO scandal, warrantless wiretapping, break-ins, burglaries, and blackmail attempts. The government had its own crimes to cover up. And by 1981, the 60s must have felt like ancient history. Ronald Reagan was about to be sworn in as president, elected on a promise to make America great again. Most of the country seemed ready to move on. As it turned out, my parents got out just in time. Later that year, some former members of the Weather Underground and the BLA tried to hold up a Brinks armored car in upstate New York. It turned into a deadly firefight, with the robbers shooting a guard and two police officers. This was a moral and political catastrophe for the movement. It led to dozens of arrests and the end of the last fragments of the underground. My parents' friends, David Gilbert and Kathy Budin, had driven a getaway truck in that robbery. Both were sentenced to decades behind bars. They left behind their infant son, Chessa, telling the babysitter they'd be back soon, and simply never came home. My parents adopted Chessa when he was just 18 months old. He became a part of our family, my second brother, and a living reminder for me of how easily I could have lost my mother and father the way Chessa lost his. "I was still breastfeeding when they were arrested," he told me. Later, I would say to them, "Why did you both have to go? It only takes one person to drive a car." Years passed. My brothers and I grew up. We went to high school. We played Little League. There were sometimes flashes from our fugitive past, a clicking sound on the phone that could be, or was I being paranoid, an FBI wiretap. Letters from Canada or Cuba arriving without postmarks. But By the time we were teenagers, my parents had regular middle-class jobs, and our family had a fairly typical American life. Our story faded from the news. Most people we met had never heard of the Weather Underground. When our friends or neighbors discovered our family's past, their reaction was usually disbelieving or mildly titillated, as if they'd found out a parent in the PTA had once been a porn star. After years of struggle and therapy, Chessa became a straight-A student, a Rhodes Scholar, and went on to Yale Law School. He eventually became the district attorney of San Francisco, part of a wave of progressive prosecutors elected during the racial reckoning over George Floyd's killing. He was later recalled, part of the backlash to that moment, and now runs a legal advocacy center at UC Berkeley's Law School, working to reform the criminal justice system from within. Asata Shakur also left behind a child, her 5-year-old daughter, Kakuya, who is now a social worker in Chicago with her own family. She last saw her mother more than 20 years ago. "I think about that a lot," Kakuya told me before her mother's death, "that she remembers me as a 15-year-old. Like, wow, my mother really doesn't know who I am as a woman. She doesn't know my children." Kakuya told me she still admires her mother's radical commitment, but also feels a sense of loss and regret about the costs of her mother's struggle. "Why would you have a child?" she asked rhetorically. "Why did you do that when you knew you couldn't raise me?" All of us kids who grew up in the underground know that feeling of being unwilling casualties of our parents' war. None of us decided to follow in our parents' violent footsteps. Most dedicated our lives to raising families and to a more incremental, peaceful type of change. Our parents, our childhood heroes, turned out to be flawed human beings who never quite lived up to their own revolutionary ideals. And we all had to live with the knowledge that their radical choices had costs, not just for us, but for the other families who were hurt, the other kids who had to grow up without their parents. I've spent years trying to untangle what I admire about my mother and father, their sacrifice and commitment, their radical solidarity with the Black Freedom Movement, from the violence and factionalism that often undermined their cause. That contradiction may be why I became a writer instead of a revolutionary, because I never quite felt their black and white moral certainty about what comes next or their radical instinct to blow things up in an effort to change the world. But I've been thinking a lot lately in this new era of racial reckoning, police violence, and rising authoritarianism about what the future will look like for our children. My wife and I have 2 daughters of our own, and I think often about how to explain to them their family story. Of course, our girls don't need to learn to recognize undercover cops or walk a trajectory. Not yet. But I still wonder what parts of the revolutionary legacy they might find useful, either as inspiration or as cautionary tale. Because this is the funny thing about inheritance. It starts as something you receive, maybe reluctantly, from your past, but it becomes something you have to decide how to pass on to the future. Recently, I sat down with my mother in her living room in Hyde Park on the south side of Chicago. She's 84 now, with silver in her hair and a network of fine wrinkles across her skin. But her green eyes are still intense, as always, watching me. "You know, it's funny," she told me. "You'll see when you're this old. I hope you get to be this old." I think about my parents more now than I have for years and years. My dad cut himself off from his family for so long. Her father, Bernard, had run away from his own parents at 14 to chase his version of the American dream. "It was ironic when I kind of replicated that pattern," she said. "Went on the run. Although it's a very American immigrant pattern, isn't it?" "Is it?" I started. "I'm not sure. Nobody else in our family ever became a revolutionary or a federal fugitive." She suddenly smiled, looking straight at me. "Your kids might," she said. You never know. And now, from the April 21st, 2026 online edition of The New Yorker, Donald Trump's triumphal arch and the architecture of autocracy. When asked by a reporter whom the arch would be for, Trump said, "Me," by Adam Gopnik. The latest in Trump's series of proposed oversized buildings, the previous one being a ballroom where the east wing of the White House once stood, a project that a federal judge temporarily halted last Thursday until an appeals court put his preliminary injunction on hold on Friday, is a so-called triumphal arch, though exactly what triumph so needs an arch is unclear. Standing at 255 feet high, presumably for the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, it would be more than twice as tall as the Lincoln Memorial, views of which it would block from its proposed site near the Arlington National Cemetery, where it would also overwhelm the simple graves of the fallen soldiers. The plans for the arch were preliminarily approved last week by the Commission of Fine Arts, which is now completely inhabited by Donald Trump's appointees, the previous members having stepped down or been fired for the crime of competence last year. The arch, designed by Nicholas Charbonneau, who leads Harrison Design's Sacred Architecture Studio in Washington, D.C., will feature a Las Vegas-style overload of gilded iconography, including a winged Lady Liberty, eagles, and, unusually for an American monument, lions. Why not Siegfried and Roy's tigers? When asked by a reporter last year whom the arch would be for, Trump said, "Me." So, really, it might more properly be called the Arch of Trump. But there is, as always with Trump, a great deal of defiance and sheer Rodney Dangerfield-style obnoxiousness implicit in the plan. It is an act of mischief as much as of monument-making. It is a very arch. Yet, bizarrely, given Trump's recent loud contempt for France's military spirit and his assaults on the French for refusing to arrive, late and unconsulted, in his war on Iran, his arch is modeled on Parisian examples. The most famous of these, the Arc de Triomphe, which was originally Napoleonic in impulse but was very long-winded in execution, is only the largest. There is a better, far more handsome example of the type in the Arc de Triomphe du Carrousel, between the Tuileries and the Louvre, which is an actual Napoleonic monument, having been completed during Napoleon's reign. The four ancient bronze horses that he stole from St. Mark's Basilica in Venice, which the Venetians had previously stolen from Constantinople, where they had been in residence after being taken earlier, most probably from somewhere in classical Greece, once stood atop it, but they had to be returned after Napoleon's fall, a rondelay of looting that perhaps suggests the dubious nature of all such triumphs. The Arc de Triomphe that everyone knows sits on the Étoile, now called the Place Charles de Gaulle, and though it was originally commissioned after the successful Napoleonic Battle of Austerlitz in 1805, construction on it was halted for a long time by the not insignificant fact that Napoleon had started losing battles about as decisively as they had ever been lost. Only decades later, when the agony of those defeats had abated a little and had been replaced by some retconned glory, which brought Napoleon's body back to its current tomb in the Invalides, was the arch completed as a consolation prize for disgruntled imperialists. Both these arches, along with a few others in Paris, were, of course, based on Roman examples, of which the still surviving arch of Septimius Severus is the most imposing, celebrating now forgotten Roman victories over Parthia, an empire that was partly located, rather notably, in what is now Iran. But what's really wrong with Trump's arch isn't something that is always wrong with victory arches, but rather something that is always wrong with all the architecture of autocracy. It lacks the modesty of intelligent self-scruple. It is not the style, but the scale that is most objectionable. It would be the largest such structure in the world, and its bigness is its point. It may be noted that Hitler wanted to build an arch in his imagined new Berlin, his Germania, also modeled on the Arc de Triomphe, and also bigger than any other arch, and also big for the sake of bigness alone. There is all the difference in the world between the sublimation of self into a heritage and the amplification of the ego into a monument. In the center of Rome today, the gigantic, glaring white monument to Victor Emmanuel II is almost universally regarded as a kind of kitsch joke, not because he wasn't, in his way, an admirable king who presided over the unification of Italy, but because the implicit insecurity of the then newborn Italian state is so evident in its appearance. It even includes winged figures like the one that appears on the top of the Trump arch. Bombast is as evident in architecture as it is in speech. If you really believe in something, including yourself, you don't need to sing its praises quite so loudly. The difference between classical choices and arbitrary colossalism is as important as the distinction between political premises and policy differences, and just as easily gets confused. With Trump, the scale and the haste and the egotism with which a thing is approached is not a side issue. It is the issue that capsizes all others. There is an uncrazy argument to be made for calling for the removal of the brutal Iranian regime. But there is no uncrazy argument to be made for choosing to go to war without a plan for the day after. There are uncrazy, if unsound, arguments for protectionist tariffs, but none for a policy of tariffs by tantrum. In the same way, when it comes to designing public buildings, there is a reasonable case to be made for classical grace, but no rational case to be made for gigantism for its own sake, and for triumphalism without a triumph. Me is not a funny answer to a question of purpose. It is a graceless one. But Trump's urge is toward gigantism, not grace. This is as true about his ballroom, which would measure some 90,000 square feet, as it is about the proposed arch. It is simply un-American. It is even, in its derivative way, un-French, since the Parisian instances are, at least, right-sized for their place and their purpose. If it were ever to be built, future generations would dream of its demolition. Its injury to the democratic spirit is too large to contemplate and would be too hard to look past, even from a distance. As usual, I'll end with some poetry. The first from the April 20th, 2026 issue of The New Yorker. Spring comes, and I finally throw out the last flowers I bought you, by Ariel Francisco. Condemned to the kitchen counter, radiated by the heartless Louisiana sun. So dry they bloomed into a fire hazard. It's been weeks. It's been months. It's been seasons. Even the ants who army crawl under the window after rain have stopped exploring those morbid petals. Even the trash can gags as they crumble to dust in its maw. The next poem is also from the April 20th issue, Clarion, by Ray Armand Trout. There are people who don't hear an internal monologue or private dialogue in their heads. I know people who don't imagine that songs on the radio are by or about them and their private affairs. Humans live in a narrow slice of time compared with dogs, for whom what we think of as recent history is still present on the air. I have dreams in which I'm not even a protagonist. I am the only one. It's like watching television with a sense of great urgency. The ornamental pear puts out just two small leaves of such a clarion red amidst the green ones that I look up the meaning of clarion and find it refers to a small, high-pitched medieval trumpet, or to the sound it made. This makes me want to weep and to be seen weeping. Do you know what I mean? And now another poem from the April 2026 issue, Apocalypso by Dobby Gibson. I couldn't finish the article about short attention spans either. Armed feds in the Wendy's. Saturn slowly losing its rings. Turns out that sinking freighter was loaded with rubber duckies, and now the beach is filthy with kids. Tiny cameras in the cash machines. A car alarm is triggering a car alarm is triggering a car alarm. Day AAO. As far as the Arctic melting goes, good thing we are already 70% water. The rest old locker combos and the memory of a kite snagged high in a tree. We probably expected too much from a people held together by something signed with a feather. Calypso held Odysseus captive on her island for years. So don't be surprised to see their ski masks getting sweaty. Look at me through your doorbell cam. The light is beautiful and a particle and a wave. We've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.